In Parshas Tetzaveh, the Torah describes the Bigdei Kohuna, the priestly vestments worn by Aaron and his descendants, the Kohanim, one of which is the Choshen. The Choshen is referred to as the Choshen Mishpat. The connection of the Choshen to Mishpat, to justice, judicial proceedings, is not at all clear. Rashi brings a couple of pshatim. One pshat is that it's called the Choshen Mishpat because it is Mechaper al Kilkul Hadin. It atones for judicial corruption. One might think that the issue of judicial corruption is limited to those who are dayanim, judges. The truth is that this is not so. The idea of Kilkul Hadin, judicial corruption, corruption in general, extends to other contexts, as we shall explore in this lecture, political contexts, electoral contexts, even commercial contexts. Throughout my years of learning Choshen Mishpat, I have been something of a connoisseur of responsa discussing judicial corruption. In this lecture, we shall explore various themes in the treatment of the poskim of judicial corruption by considering various tshuvos in which various scenarios of corruption are discussed. We begin with the Gemara. The Gemara says, Bar Chama katal nafsha. The Gemara in Zeborer, Bar Chama had murdered somebody, or was alleged to have murdered somebody. Amalei Reish Galusa L'Rav Abba Yaakov, the Reish Galusa delegated the case to Rav Abba Yaakov, Puk Ayin Ba, consider his case, Ivadai Kotal, if indeed it can be established beyond a reasonable doubt that he killed, L'chayuhu L'Eina. Some dire penalty, Rashi brings three pshatim, actually poking out his eyes, or a knas, Rashi says, or taking his property and giving it to his heirs, or a cherim. Rashi prefers the first pshat, that it means the gory punishment of blinding him. So the proceedings began. Asu treis adde yashidu be'devadei katal. Two witnesses testified that he had indeed definitely murdered someone. Azal ihu, he, the defendant, brought two witnesses. Asu treis adde yashidu be'bechad mehanach. They testified that one of the two witnesses for the prosecution was actually pasul, was a thief. Chadamara kamay didi ganav kaba de chushla. One of them testified that he had stolen a kav, a measure of chushla. Rashi says seorim klufim, peeled barley. Chadamara kamay didi ganav kata de bertaya, the handle of a spear. So they were ganavim, so he was a ganav, so he was pasul. Gemara then gets into a question of whether this indeed would render the edim invalid for a capital case. The Gemara goes back and forth on this point. At the end of the day, the Gemara says that Rav Papi, who had been arguing for the defense, Rav Papi persuaded the Dayan, whoever was deciding the case, Rav Abba Yaakov, that the eight witnesses for the prosecution were indeed psulim, invalid. Defendant was acquitted. Defendant was so grateful. Kam Bar Chama, the defendant arose, Nashke Akari, he kissed Rav Papi on his legs, his feet, in gratitude, v'kabli l'karga de kule shnei. He agreed to pay off his taxes for all his years. Now the Rush adds to this Gemara that really, Rabbanim are anyway exempt from karga. Hilkach lo avikishochan mu'ucher. The Rush was bothered, how can a litigant, how can a defendant give a present to the dayan, to someone who is influential in his acquittal? Isn't that shochet? And even if it occurs after the court case, it's shochet meucher. So the Rush says, well, really, he was potter anyway. So that's why it's not like shochet meucher. The Pilpula Charifta on the Rush runs with this. He says, bo re'e dover gadol sheshmiyana rabbeinu. The Rush is telling us a great principle, a very important rule. The shochet asur af bedover she'en adin Torah. Bribery is prohibited even in a context where they are not actually ruling according to Din Torah. El derech knas ba'alma, as Rashi explains, this was not Din Torah. We don't have capital punishment b'zman hazeh. This was a knas of the Reish Galusa. Even though they were actually ruling based on the technical halachic rules of procedure of Edim and Psulim, but still, since ultimately the case was one of knas, the Pilpul Charifta infers from here that the Rush still was bothered by the issue of Shochad, and had to give this explanation. Kasafti Zeh, the Pilkrifta says, Lahoros, to teach Nemanim Alatzibur, those who are the political, the elected representatives of the community, Afal Pisha Ein Dineim Din Torah, even though they're not judges in the strict sense, they're not ruling according to Torah law, Blonis Kablu Lekach, They still have to be careful. They must avoid accepting presents for their rulings. Now, one does find a contrasting svara in the Chavos Yar. The Chavos Yar has a tshuva on bribery. The specific question was bribing non-Jewish courts. Now, we should note, let there be no mistake about this, the consensus of the poskim, it may not be unanimous, but there's a strong consensus of the poskim that bribery is always prohibited, even outside of Beis Din, even to non-Jewish courts. Chavos Yar himself concludes that if the person offering the bribe knows that he is in fact guilty, he is in fact liable, and offers the bribe to the judge to corrupt him, Chas v'shalom, he says, if he's Yodea Shadinim Chavero, and he asks the Dayan to distort the din, then he has a double and triple sin, he says. Gezel, Shochad, Ivus Hadin, he's stealing, he's bribing, he's corrupting the proceeding, the judicial proceeding, Michshel Chavero, he's causing others to sin, Ein Chiluk Ben Yisrael Lagoy, there is no difference between Jews and non-Jews. Nevertheless, in the context of the tshuva, the Chavos Yar does propose a svara that in a case where the Jew does not actually know that he is liable, he says there are many cases where the law is actually unclear. Many cases, he says, it's not a black and white question. I did borrow money, I didn't borrow money. He says there are cases where they honestly don't know what the din is. There are complicated and subtle questions of halacha where the din is not actually very clear. He says, dine shomrim, rov dine mamonos. Shochet should be in principle heter gomer, he says. And if this is what the dayan comes out, that itself is correct law. He says, maybe not. Maybe you'll tell me that there is an objective truth, he says, and if you manipulate the dayan into deviating from that objective truth, even if he means well, but there is an actual truth out there, and if he misses it, the din is wrong, the din is false. He says, no. Chavos Yar makes a stunningly postmodern point. He says, no. Lazaz Ashiv, Kiluyihi Kain Mishpat Hashem. That's true in Torah. Torah, there is an objective truth. Ki Chayoseina, Imakim Kadosh Chutzvu. They have been quarried out of a holy place. Ve'einam Benuyim Klal Shikol Das Adam. They're not built on human judgment. He says, Babadine Adam, Ein Rael Mishpatah Benuyim Al Das Nota. There's no comparison to laws, like general laws of society, which are built just on people's own intellectual inclinations, v'seichel anushi, v'tikun ha'yishuv ha'kibbutz, on pragmatism, on how to run society effectively and efficiently. There is no objectively right or wrong answer. So whatever the judge rules, as long as he's not deliberately corrupting the din, even if he's been swayed subconsciously by a bribe, that din cannot be called a mishpa mekolkol, a mishpa checker. And therefore, in principle, there would not necessarily be any issur of shochad in paying such a bribe, and it would follow here, the issue is not Jew and not Jew. The issue would seem to be that anytime you're not dealing with actual Mishpat Hashem, even with Jewish groups, if it was an arbitration panel, if it was a political decision, as we're going to discuss soon, rather than a judicial proceeding, it would seem, according to this svara of the Chavos Yar, that there would not necessarily be an Isser of Shochet. Now, ironically, in the actual case the Rosh is going on, the case of Bar Chama, where even though it was a Knas, but the actual procedural question was one of Din Torah. Did Eidus, as to the Gneva, would such an Eidus actually render the original Eidim unfit for Din Nefashos? That actually is a Din Torah. But nevertheless, in many of the cases, where the case of Pul Charifta, where the Nemanim are not involved in Din Torah at all, they're just making political decisions, practical decisions, decisions for the sake of expedience. In such cases, the Chavos Yar is proposing a svara, whether he actually holds this way halach l'maaseh or not, but he's proposing a svara that the technical issur of shochad would not apply. Nevertheless, as we are about to see, various other poskim do take for granted, explicitly and implicitly, that even non-judicial bodies have to retain their integrity, have to vote l'shem shemayim, and certainly that if there's any shochad involved, that completely invalidates, voids any decision they take. We begin with a tshuva of the Maram Bar Baruch, the Maram of Rattenberg, a very, very important and fundamental tshuva on democracy as it was practiced in the medieval period by the German Jews. The question was the central basic question any society faces, any democracy faces, Sha'alta. Im yesh kitata ben kahalchem, the community has a dispute. Ve'einam yichalim lahashvaz daitam, they can't reach consensus. Livra rushim baskamas kulam. They're going to appoint a representative body, an executive body, to make decisions, but they cannot reach consensus on who this body should consist of. Zelmer Beko, Zelmer Beko, Machmas Chiluk Liba, and because of these disagreements, Batal Atamid, the normal order and routine is collapsing, Midas Adin Loka, Vein Emes, Umishpat, Vashalom Be'er, things clearly can't go on this way. We have to reach some kind of solution. Lo B'chol HaMalchus and the Gorah Mechorechem Echiasu, what should we do in the absence of consensus? How do we resolve our differences? Nira Beinai, says Maram, and he establishes the basic rule of democracy. Sheyesh Lahoshev Kol Balei Batim Shenos Nimas, not quite our democracy, one man, one vote, but one taxpayer, one vote. The 47% do not, only the 47% vote, the 53% or whatever it is, do not get to vote. V'kablu aleihem bracha, that means apparently through a cherem. Shekol echad yomer daita l'shem shamayim. This is the key line. Everyone must express his opinion l'shem shamayim, ula takonas ha'er, and for the benefit of the city. And then v'yelchu acharov, majority rule, hein livra rashim, to appoint these leaders, hein lahamid chazanim, to appoint chazanim, hein latakin kishal tzedakah, to arrange the collection and distribution of tzedakah, hein lamanas gabayim, to appoint gabayim, hein livnos, hein lister v'sekneses, to do construction and demolition on the shul, lahosif v'ligra, v'liknos beis chasnos, to buy a wedding hall, livnos v'listener boat, to build and do demolition of the wedding hall, liknos beis ofim, a bakery, livnos v'listener boat, self-dover, kol tzarech ha-kahal, any communal need, yasu al piyem, should be done according to these rashim, kechol asher yomru, whatever these rashim, these leaders were going to be the ones making decisions at all these other issues, if the minority still refuses to go along, geish koch b'yad harov, to force them to, and he goes on like this. So that's his rule. That you take a vote, you elect representatives, these representatives then have complete power to make all necessary decisions on behalf of the city. But the Maram, in explaining this electoral procedure, Maram insists, kol echad yomer daita l'shem shamayim. Everyone must express his opinion l'shem shamayim ul'takana se'er, for the benefit of the city. I have long wondered exactly how far to take this. Let's say, for example, the debate is whether to build a wall. I happen to be the local stonemason. Obviously, building walls is in my financial interest. Do I have to recuse myself? Do I have to somehow suppress my personal economic interests and try to think what I would vote if I wouldn't have this economic interest? Maybe yes, maybe that's what you have to do. But anyway, we will soon see several examples of more clear-cut cases of what the poskim understood this maram to mean. We have a similar din in the Trumas Hadeshen. Trumas Hadeshen makes the point that the Tuvei Ha'er, these Rashim, these communal leaders, have the same rules, the same status as Dayana. The case here was, there was a person in the community who had been caught taking a false oath, and based on apparently a false oath on a financial matter. He had been fined. The community had settled with him about the fine. They agreed to accept something, bimochel, whatever it is they made up with him. And now they wanted to appoint him. They had agreed to appoint him. They wanted to appoint him to political position to be one of these Tuvei Ha'er. They asked the Maram, is that okay? Because he never actually did proper tshuva. Certainly a person who does tshuva, is tshuva wipes the slate clean. But this person had never done a proper formal tshuva. So they wanted to know, is he in good enough standing to hold public office? The Trumas Hadeshen says, no, he is not. Ein atem rashayim lo shiva b'kal kedem avur. Elam kein, yasek var tshuva. Al pi echem rebetena bali haros. In those days, they used to have formal tshuva. A person would go to a rav. The rav would assign him formal penance, fasts, other types of things he would have to accept. And the Trumas Hadeshen explains, because by taking a false oath, he's a rasha, ra'la shamayim, ra'la brias. Until he does tshuva, he's not eligible to hold office. And the Trumas Hadeshen explains, again, similar to the Maram, Tuvei Ha'er, kishe yoshvin l'fakech l'iskei rabim, the communal leaders, when they sit to make arrangements for public affairs, v'yachidim, for individual affairs, b'makom beistin kaimi, they're just like a beistin, and Rishayim cannot sit on a beistin. So while the Maram was saying that the electors even, not just the leaders, the electors themselves have to express their opinion l'shem shamayim, Trumas Hadeshen is saying, certainly those elected leaders themselves have the status of a beis din, and they have to have the qualifications of a beis din. They cannot be Rishayim, just as a beis din cannot consist of Rishayim. Both these dinim, the Maram and the Trumas Hadeshen, are both brought by the Ramah. regarding the Maram, the Ramah Paskins, that they have to say Daitim L'Shem Shemayim. Regarding the Tuvei HaKahal, the Ramah Paskins, Tuvei HaKahal, and Amunim Lasik B'Tzarchei Rabbim, doesn't get into all the details of the Truma Sessions case. He just says that the communal leaders, Rabbim HaYechidim, Haram Kedayanim, they have the status of Dayanim, V'Asurim L'Hoshe B'Neim, Mishapasel L'Dun, Mishum Risha. It is prohibited to seat among them anyone who would be possible to be a Dayan because of Rishas. So we move now to a tshuva of the Chasam Sefer, a notorious case. There was a certain community that was trying to decide upon a Rav. They had four candidates. They agreed to the following voting procedure. Instead of one vote with all four candidates, they would have a series of binary votes, of yes-no votes on the four candidates. The first one who would receive a majority in his favor would obtain the position. The first two were voted down. The third one was voted up. And then a terrible scandal broke. There was a rumor, there were actual documents, there were claims that bribery had occurred, that the third winning candidate himself, or at least his agents, had, or people acting on his behalf, had bribed some of the members of the community, members of the city, to vote down the first ones and throw the vote in favor of their candidate. So the question came to the Chasam Sofer, whether this vote is binding, or whether we throw out the whole vote, and indeed, can the Rav even run again if they have a new vote? Chasam Sofer rules that if it can be established by two proper Eidim, two Eidim Ksherim, who are not members of the community, or not related to the community, not related to the Rav, if two good, completely disinterested Eidim can tell us that bribery has occurred, then it's Pashut Kebei Bekudcha. It is completely obvious, he says, that this vote is not binding. Why? So he gives two reasons. First, he brings the Ramah, who brings the language of the Maram, that electors, people in the city who vote for leaders, have to express their opinion L'Shem Shemayim. Anyone who has accepted a bribe, anyone who has sold his vote, by definition, has not expressed his opinion L'Shem Shemayim. That is one reason. And this is, when the Pesach Tshuva brings this Chasam Sofer, this is the part he brings. Pesach Tshuva actually omits another very interesting section of the Chasam Sofer, that right after he says that, he brings the Trumas Hadeshin, the Ramah who brings the Trumas Hadeshin, that Tuvei HaKahal Amunim Lasik B'Tzarchei Rabbim Haram Kedayanim V'Asir L'Hoshe B'Neim Mishapasel L'Adun Mishum Risha. That he says, even since a notel schar ladun, even not bribery, someone who simply charges to hear a case. Ar Batei Din do hear cases, and the postum have struggled for hundreds of years to explain why, but the Ikar LaHalacha is that a dayan may not charge a fee to hear a case. So since the Trumas Hadeshin and the Ramah tell us that those who vote, those who make decisions on behalf of the community are like dayanim and cannot be rishayim, so anyone who has taken shochad cannot be a dayan, cannot be an elector. So besides the Maram's din that electors have to express their opinion L'Shem Shemayim, Chasam Sofer adds an additional rule that they have to be kosher. They can't be rishayim. So anyone who has accepted a bribe, we have two problems. First, he has not expressed his opinion L'Shem Shemayim. Second, the act of taking a bribe apostles him because he's no longer like a kosher dayan. So that's the ruling of the Chasam Sofer. Chasam Sofer adds that regarding the election for the third Rav, the third vote that voted him up, even if he still had a majority absent the votes of those electors who had taken bribes, the vote still has to be redone because the other people can say, we only voted up your third candidate after the first two were voted down. And the first two were voted down because of bought votes. So even the third one that we voted for him, because we had no choice, because our first two candidates were already ruled out. Soon we will see another reason why the vote might have to be thrown out, even if the number of bought votes was a minority, and even if the winning candidate had a majority, even after the bought votes have been discounted. This basic rule of the Maram, the Trumas Hadeshin, the Chasam Sofer, that electors and office holders have to be people who are eligible to be Dayanim, cannot be Rishayim, and cannot be bribed, and cannot be tendentious in expressing their personal interests, This actually appears in other contexts too, besides that of Shochad. There is contemporary discussion about what category to put modern governments in general, and the government of the State of Israel in particular. So Din Malchus obviously is the most widely discussed category, but there's also some discussion as to whether the modern Knesset, the modern Israeli government, constitutes the equivalent of the Zayin Tuvaher, the elected communal leaders that the medieval authorities all talk about. Rav Adya Hadayan, the Askel Avdi, says yes, the government constitutes the Zayin Tuvaher. Rav Ezra Batzri, in his Dine Mamonos, vehemently rejects this. He says the rule is, as we've seen, Tuvaher have to be tzaddikim. They have to be people eligible to be dayanim, he says. Certainly, people who are Rishayim, people who have expressed hostility to the Torah, at least some Knesset members, he says, have said that their goal, their desire is to uproot the Torah, to uproot religion. Certainly, such people cannot be valid as members of the Tuvei Ha'er. Rav Yehuda Silman of Bnei Brak goes even further. He argues that the fact that the government it contains or is Rishayim invalidates the government entirely, even through the category, even from the category of Din Malchus Adina. And moreover, he argues that even suffrage, he says, the mere fact that anyone, the people who are not religious, and people who are not, even people who are not Haredim, he says, is a problem. I don't know if he is using Haredim synonymously with Datiyim, if he's aware of the difference, if he's just using the terms generally, but even people who are not Haredim, he says, they have no right to vote, because as we've seen, the electors have to be only Ksherim. People who are not Ksherim can't vote, insofar as the suffrage extends to those who are not Yisraelim Ksherim, that itself invalidates the whole vote, he says. Another interesting application of this appears in the Tshuvas Hamar of Rabbi Elazar Prial, Rabbi Elazar Meir Prial, of Elizabeth, Rabbi Taitz's father-in-law. He says, he's discussing the question of female suffrage, which was a very controversial topic among the Gedolim about 100 years ago, the early part of the 20th century, when it was a topic in the rest of the world. And many Gedolim had ruled, as Rav Prial even indicates, that it was the consensus at the time he wrote the Tshuva, that women, according to Torah, should not be able to vote. Why not? So Rav Prial proposes an idea. He says, based on what we've seen, electors, not just political leaders, electors themselves, as the Maram says, have to be magidai from L'shem Shemayim, and women can certainly do that, but the Truma Sanhedrin says that they have to be kosher as dayanim. Since the consensus of the poskim, the halacha follows the view that women cannot be dayanim, so too, he says, women cannot be electors. Women can't vote. So as I said earlier, it's really very unclear how far to take this Truma Sanhedrin Maram. What do we really mean when we say they have to be L'shem Shemayim? What do we really mean that they have to have all the qualifications of Dayanim? We've seen the Rav Silman, Rav Batzri, Rav Prial take it pretty far, but the Chaim Sofer at least says that what it certainly includes is corruption. Electors who have been bought, electors who are corrupt, their vote is void and has to be thrown out. Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein talks about a similar case where the Vad Shchuna, the neighborhood association, or the Vad Bayit, the association of a building, were elected via bribery. He discusses whether the vote is binding or not. He does not bring up the Chaim Sofer, which is odd, since the Chaim Sofer is the basic tshuva on this question. Instead, he brings the Chazon Ish, who says that if the Zayin Tuvei Ha'er that were selected, Einam Tovim Be'emes, if they're not really the good men for the job, those who voted for them did not do what the Maram said of voting L'Shem Shemayim. Elokavi Kiruv Dayatam L'Nosh Mesuyamim, out of partiality to specific people, then the selection is void, Ein L'Nevrarim Shum Koch. So Rav Zilberstein is mefalpel about what the Chazon Ish exactly means, and his conclusions are as follows. If the seven Tuvaher, if the elected representatives are not qualified and they were picked via bribery, then their selection certainly has no validity. Even if, he says, they are competent, they are qualified, but there exist those who are more qualified and the less qualified ones were picked via bribery, then their selection is also void. If they are the best men for the job, then even though bribery occurred and people paid electors to vote for them, then their selection is still valid. It's a little hard to understand what these rules mean in practice. He speaks as though it's meaningful to objectively say this is the best candidate for the job and not this one, we usually view things that the whole point of an election is to determine who's the best candidate. If there was a self-evident best candidate, we wouldn't be voting on this. So obviously, either it's not clear or there are different standards by which to judge. It is true that other postgame also have occasionally made comments like this about is the person the best person or not the best person, but practically speaking, it's difficult to know what to make of the standard, how to apply this litmus test, is he the best person for the job or not? In any event, though, that which he doesn't seem to mention anywhere, that the Shochet itself, regardless of whether the best men won or not, the Shochet itself should invalidate the whole election process, which is a conservative point based on the Maram and the Truman Sedation. He just discusses whether the best people for the jobs or not, and does not seem to think that bribery in and of itself is a reason to throw out the whole procedure. That seems to be against the Chasam Sofer. Now, as we mentioned earlier, the Chasam Sofer briefly raises the question, what happens if in the third vote in his case, in which the one candidate finally won a majority, what happens if some of the votes for him were bought? But even if we disregard those votes, he still had a majority. Is his election still valid? Kamsarfer said no, but he gave a technical reason, because the earlier votes to vote down other candidates were affected by the bribery, and those who voted for the third Rav can say, we only voted for him after our candidate had been eliminated. The Tshura Shai, Rav Shlomo Yehuda Tabak, has a much more basic reason for invalidating any vote in which some of the votes were bought, even if the winning position or the winning candidate still achieved a majority. He talks about the following interesting case. There were 7 Tuvaheir. They were considering whether to institute a Chakira Shel Yayin. It was basically a tax on wine that anyone who would consume wine or would sell wine had to pay a certain tax. And as was often done in the European countries, the tax would not be collected and administered by the government itself. The tax, the right to collect the tax, would be sold to a private citizen. The government this way would take a flat sum of money up front, and this person would then obtain whatever revenue he could based on the rules of the tax. So the Zayin Tuvei Ha'er, the communal leaders, were considering instituting such a tax. One particular businessman was interested in purchasing this tax if they would institute it. So he therefore wanted the tax to go through. He was worried that during these legislative deliberations, there was one of the 7 Tuvei Ha'er who was going to vote against it, and perhaps even persuade the others to vote against it. The reason he thought this person was opposed to it was because this person himself was in the wine business, and he had wine to sell. The tax would therefore be against his own personal interest, and he thought that would sway the whole body not to implement this tax. So he paid off that particular member of the panel to vote in favor of the rule, and sure enough, they did institute his tax, and he was now going to buy it. When people found out what had happened, they wanted to void the whole vote on the ground that he had tampered with the proceedings and the whole proceedings were corrupt and they should be thrown out. The Tshura Shai, in this and in other tshuvas, takes a very strong anti-corruption stance and says, Pashut, that this agreement, this decision to implement the tax is not binding because one of the votes was bought. He says, even though you have 6, even though all 7 agreed, so even without this corrupt vote, you still had 6 votes, 6 out of a possible 7 in favor. He brings a Chuvas HaRashba that when 2 people accept a panel of 10 to make a pshara, to arbitrate their dispute, you need all 10, you need unanimity, and if even one of them doesn't have an opinion, he leaves, doesn't want to express an opinion, then the entire agreement is void, and they're not bound by what the remaining arbitrators decide, even if all 9 of them agree. Why? So the Rashba explains, because maybe had that person been there, maybe he would have managed to persuade them not to rule the way they did. So that's why you need all 10. The quorum has to be the full 10. Without that, even if it's unanimous among the remaining 9, it is not binding upon the litigants, the disputants. So here too, he says, had this seventh member of the Tuvaheir not been bought, perhaps he would have come up with some reason against the Chakiris, and the other ones would have agreed. So that's a reason why we throw out the whole decision. Moreover, he says, even if The RASPA's rule does not apply, even if we're dealing with a situation where there is an explicit institution or a custom to not require unanimous decisions, to allow 6 votes if one of the people is away or busy or has no opinion. We don't require all 7, we allow 6, not like the RASPA. Still, he says, that only means that if one of them is not available, if one of them declines to express an opinion, we can rule without him. But if one of them has been bought, tampered with, then this does not apply. Why? He makes 2 distinctions. First of all, he makes a pragmatic distinction. He says if people agree not to require unanimity, that's because it's not practical, because getting all 7 there at the same time, the people have their own businesses, these are not full-time legislators, they have their own affairs to attend to. So if you wait for all 7, one of them will be away. By the time he comes back, someone else will go away. So for practical reasons, we can foresee situations where it'll be difficult to get all 7 in the same time in the same place, so we allow less than 7. But corruption, that was never envisioned. Where one of them is bought, that was never something that the people who established this custom or this rule envisioned. Corruption, certainly, we go back to the original rule that you need unanimity, and a corrupt member does not count, and we have no unanimity, and therefore their decision is not valid. Another svara, he says, even more interesting, and this is where we return to the Chasam Sofer, another reason he says is that the Rashba says, why normally do we need unanimity? Because maybe if that 10th person who isn't here, if he were here, he could have made arguments, he could have persuaded the others to come around to the alternate position. Here the problem is the reverse, says the Churashai. The legislator who was bought, maybe had he not been bought, he himself would have ruled the other way, and he would have persuaded the other one, and maybe because he was bought, he persuaded the other ones to rule incorrectly. He brings a Targum Yonasan. The Torah says, Ki ashalchad yaver pechim, v'yisalef divrei tzadikim. It says, Ki ashalchad yaver pechim, and the Targum says, V'shalchad ala lakabel, one may not accept shalchad, arum shalchad amasame ene nasvay, shalchad, bribery blinds the eyes of those who take it, u'metaltel chakimaya, mimos v'nehon. Also, it moves away chachamim from their established positions. And the Mefarish, the commentator of the Yonasan, says that these are 2 separate things. First, kishikabel shalchad, matas lacham hayoshim etzlam, midarach yishuvim ledarach hashav. Not only does it corrupt the individual recipient of the shalchad, he then turns around, the corruption infects his colleagues, and he persuades all of them to side with his derech hashav, his false and bad position. Therefore, says the Churashai, even if we accept that we don't need a quorum, and that 9 out of 10 or 6 out of 7 would be good, but if one of them has been corrupted, the taint of the corruption can spread to all 10, to all 7. It's like we have nobody now. That's even worse than one of them goes away. So returning to the Chasam Sofer, these arguments would apply in his case too. Even if only a small minority of the electors had been corrupted, assuming there was some electioneering going on before the vote, assuming they discussed it with each other, one could make the same argument. The corrupt, bought electors may have spread the taint of their corruption to the others, and therefore the entire vote would have to be thrown out. Now it's interesting, because in the case of the Churashai, he explicitly notes in the Shaila, when he sets up the question, although he does not return to this at all really in his discussion, he explicitly notes that the person who bought one of the 7 Tuva Ha'er did so because he was afraid of counter-corruption. He was afraid that one, I don't know why the 7th legislator, the 7th one of the Tuva Ha'er, was not recusing himself if he had a strong financial interest. I don't know why nobody else cared about this. But he was afraid that one of the Tuvim would vote against him for the wrong reasons, would vote against the Chakiris, even if it was in the interest of the community, because he had a financial stake in wine, and he would not want this tax because it would hurt his own business. Now, certainly, if he were to do that, that would certainly violate the Maram's rule of everyone has to express his opinion l'shem shemayim. Maram was talking about even regular electors, certainly the Zayin Tuva Ha'er, the representatives, certainly have a duty to vote in the community's interest rather than their own. And he was simply paying him to avoid that illegitimate potential tendentiousness on his part. Maram, the Churashai, nevertheless, does not seem to think that makes a difference. He does not mention that point at all in his analysis. The fact that he was only paying him off to avoid unfair tendentiousness against his interest doesn't make a difference. This point also occurs, though, in the Chavos Yair. This point is mentioned in the same Tshuva of the Chavos Yair on bribery that we mentioned earlier. Earlier we discussed the Chavos Yair's own analysis of bribery. Earlier in the Tshuva, he discusses a celebrated interchange between his brother-in-law, Rav Itzik, Rav Isaac Brillin. He was the Av Beis and Rosh Masifta of Mannheim and the province of Pfalz, who was friendly, apparently, with someone he calls the Duke Karl Ludwig Zal, HaMuflug B'Chachma. Karl Ludwig, apparently he was the Elector of the Palatine. He was Muflug B'Chachma, exceptionally wise, and this Duke would be Mishtashel Aprakim in discussing intellectual matters. He would enjoy intellectual conversation with the Chavos Yair's brother-in-law, this Rav Itzik Brillin. So once the Duke complained to Rav Itzik, he says, "You Jews, you're Balabatim," he says, "it's your job to guide them, to set them on the right path. They're behaving terribly," he says. "It's not enough that they're constantly quarreling and they're always in my halls of justice. Not only are they clogging up the justice system," he says, "they're mekalkalim asayim v'chotim, and not only that, but they're chote umachti, they're corrupting my judges, they're constantly bribing them," he says, "which is terrible. How can they do that?" So Rav Itzik concedes, beginning and end of his remarks, this is terrible, there's no heter, anything I'm going to say, he says, is just their own rationalizations, and I'm not saying it's mutter, chas v'shalom. But after all is said and done, he gives three reasons, three possible justifications that these people may have for bribery. One of them is, he says, the person who gives the bribe doesn't actually want to corrupt the judge and in his favor. Rocky says, each one is afraid the other one is bribing. So he's just counter-bribing to even out the playing field and to bring it back to a fair fight. Another one of his reasons is similar, he says, Ein sinna kesinas hadas, famous expression, there's no hatred like religious hatred. Whenever a Jew, he says, faces a non-Jew, a Christian, the judge will naturally be sympathetic to the Christian. And that's not fair. The judge is doing the avla. The judge is not giving the Jew a fair trial. By bribing the judge, again, the Jew is simply evening out the playing field and ensuring, enabling himself to get a fair deal. So the Duke laughed and said, the Duke said, that's fine when one's a Christian. What about when they're both Jews? So Rav Itzik said, then I have to use the other answers, including the one we said that he thinks the other Jew is bribing. So the Duke ended up by laughing and said, Haducha Sachak, you laughed, Amar Chastan Milech, you speak well, you're clever. Im ki adati, I know perfectly well, Shari Turtzen Lonidalu, you can always make excuses, Hand Emes, Hand Beshaker, between you, me, and the lampposts, he was saying, your parishioners are corrupt and they're corrupting my judges. I'll call upon him. We see Rav Itzik mention two variations, actually, of this Svara. We find a similar one in the Chasam Sofer too, in another Tshuva. Two variations of the Svara, at least somewhat legitimizing bribery. He's not saying it's mutter, he says it's only rationalizations, but at least pointing out that there is at least some legitimization for bribery if you're only doing it to counterbalance a bribe on the other side or some other kind of illegitimate tendentiousness against you, which was really what the guy in the Shur Shai was doing. He felt that one of the Tuvah Ha'er would have his own tendentiousness, unfair tendentiousness against the proposal, and all he was doing was evening it out, but nevertheless, the Shur Shai felt that was completely illegitimate bribery. As I mentioned, the Tshuva Shai in various tshuvas takes a vehemently anti-corruption position. He has another tshuva. This one also deals with a government that was renting out a tax. In this case, it was a bridge tax, a toll, I guess. It was not the Jewish tshuva here. This was the general government. The government would offer up this tax at an auction. Again, the system would be that the government would say, who wants the Verrazano toll for a year? Somebody would say 10,000, somebody would say 20,000, somebody would say 30,000. The highest bid would be awarded the toll. He would pay 30,000 to the government, and he would be entitled to collect the toll on the bridge for the year. One person who wanted to buy this toll but wasn't particularly interested in paying the fair price at a free and fair auction, so he simply bribed various officials to give it to him without the due process of the auction, without a fair auction. Someone else gained wind of what he was doing. So he simply counter-bribed. He bribed officials and said, give it to me. The first guy was outraged. He said, Anim habit b'charara. other such tinus. I was here first. I had an agreement. How dare you steal my stolen bridge tax from me? This is classic chutzpah, but that was his taina. And the Shurashai indeed throws the book against the plaintiff, dismisses his claim entirely. The thrust of his tshuva is to argue that there is a principle based on Rishonim that any time a person does something which is an avla, does something wrong, unfair to others, and then has the chutzpah to try to claim protection from a takanas chazal against interference, ani mahapech or other takanas of chazal, we dismiss his claim. A person has no right to invoke takanas chazal to defend his own rights if his own rights are based on conduct which is illegitimate. So the Churashai devotes the bulk of his tshuva to showing that what this first guy had done by bribing judges to throw him the bridge tax without the free and fair auction according to the rules was completely illegitimate. And he has complicated and detailed arguments. We're not going to get into all the details, but at the end of the day, he argues that he's violating the prohibition of shochad. He says the halacha is that shochad applies even to non-Jews. He's over gzeila. He's stealing from the government. Oh no, gzeila. He's defrauding them. He's also defrauding all the travelers across the bridge, he says. Since his purchase of the tax from the government is illegitimate, any money he takes from them is illegitimate. It's the government's money, since his purchase of it from them is not legitimate. So it's gezel, ona, shochad, stealing from the travelers. He also adds a very interesting and very important svara, that even insofar as some of the rules might be different when applied to non-Jews or non-Jewish governments, he says here, where all members of the city benefit from services, and there are Jews in the city, and also he says the taxes will have to be raised to provide the same services if the appropriate revenues are not realized, are not achieved, he says, and then he's stealing from Jews. Forget government, forget non-Jews, he's stealing from Jews. He says, Kol b'nei ha'medina b'nei ha'ir m'shutafin bo, b'ein goyim b'ein yehudim. Even though all the services the government provides go to all the citizens, including Jews, like fixing roads, he says, building roads, fixing roads. Also, he says they're going to have to raise the taxes. Then Jews are also involved. So then there's no issue of non-Jewish. All the discussions they're posting about non-Jewish governments and non-Jews, all those halakhs are not relevant because here you're dealing with Jews, he says. So the earlier poskim did discuss different sets of rules for Jews and non-Jews sometimes, he says. That's only when the Jews don't benefit from it. Sounds like a strange ukimta, but that's what he says. This obviously creates a revolution in Choshen Mishpat and the Sugyos of Din Malchusa. This is beyond the scope of this lecture. But anyway, as I said, he consistently throughout the tshuva throws the book at the plaintiff and says he's doing all manner of avlas, gezel, ona, shochad, gezel from the other citizens, gezel from the other taxpayers of the country, from the other citizens of the country. And since what he's doing is thoroughly illegitimate from beginning to end, therefore, he has absolutely no right to claim protections under the Takanas Chazal, such as Ani Mehapich Bacharar. Next tshuva we discuss, a tshuva in the different Malkiel. The last one was chutzpah. This one is even more chutzpah. A person, an incumbent rav in a certain locale, was selling his rabbinic incumbency. This may sound a little odd to modern ears, but this was common in the 19th century. A rabbi who would leave a town would sell the rabbinate to the incoming candidate. The city would also have to sign off on the candidate, but nobody could take the position without first reaching an agreement with the outgoing candidate, the outgoing rav. The custom was he would demand payment to sell his chazaka of the rabbinate in the city. This is a separate discussion. How legitimate is this really? Different Kiel doesn't directly object to this, but again, discussion not for this lecture. So this Rav, who had held the position, who held the incumbency, was planning on making Aliyah. So he agreed to sell the chazaka of his Rabbanus to the incoming candidate for 600 rubles in cash. Additionally, here's where the chutzpah comes in. Additionally, the father-in-law of the incoming candidate was a gabbai tzedakah of money that was raised in Europe to support people in Eretz Yisrael. He said, I want 50 rubles a month from that fund. So that was the deal they made. Turned out the deal fell through because the woman did not want to make Aliyah. She felt even with all this money, they wouldn't have enough to support themselves in Israel, so they wanted to renege on the deal. So the bulk of the tshuva is about Hilchos Kinyanim, whether this deal is binding or not, whether they have the right to renege or not. But in the middle of the tshuva, the Divrei Hakil raises the question of corruption. He says, finally, after going on for a page or so, he says, this part of the deal, he says, to get 50 rubles from a tzedakah fund, he says, that's Fianera who gazel gomer. You're stealing, the father-in-law is stealing money from his tzedakah money to buy his son a rabbinic position. How could he buy his son a shteller with tzedakah money that he controls? This condition is not binding, and the whole deal unravels because of that. Now he says, the truth is, he says, the donors, when they give this money, do grant the father-in-law authority to disperse it as he sees fit. Still, but he can't use it to buy his son-in-law a position. Even, he says, this Rav was actually making Aliyah. So even if the father-in-law does feel that this outgoing Rav is a good candidate for the money, so why is it stealing? He says, Mikolakam, Harayun Agaba Dabar. He has an interest because he's buying a position for his son-in-law with the money. Because he has a vested interest, it is prohibited for him to make such decisions. Uchiyadua, returning again to that Sfara of the Trumas Hadeshen, Degabai Tzedakah him kedayanam shekibla malayam atzibur. A Gabai Tzedakah is like a dayan, and it is therefore prohibited for him to have personal interest in the decision that he makes. Final tshuva we discuss here. Up till now, we've been dealing with judicial corruption, political corruption, electoral corruption, corruption of various sorts of public service or of civic duties. We close with one case of corruption, simple commercial corruption, a kickback. There was an apotropis, an agent, who was arranging for the rental of a house that belonged to someone else. He rented out the house for less than the fair market value, but took a 30 ruble kickback for himself. It turned out that the house burned down, and now the debate apparently was whether he has to refund the 30 rubles that he personally took along with the rent in general. The tenant had apparently prepaid rent for some period of time. The house burned down in the midst of that duration. The question was, does the apotropis, the agent, does he have to return the kickback? Divrei Chaim, who had this of Sanz, who was asked this question, insists vigorously the answer is absolutely yes. Divrei Chaim's correspondent had apparently held that no, he wanted to look at this kickback as essentially shadchanus, an agency fee. The agent was saying, give me a fee, pay me a fee, line my pockets, and I'll arrange a rental, but this money he's taking is not part of the rental. So just like had the broker arrange for a customer to buy something, and the next day that object had an accident and was destroyed, the broker's fee he keeps because the deal was consummated, the deal went through. The fact that you didn't have a long, happy term of enjoyment from it is not my problem. So he wanted to look at this the same way, that the kickback that the broker had taken, that the agent had taken was simply a brokerage fee, and the fact that the tenant did not unfortunately get a very long and happy usage of the property it's not his problem. The Divrei Chaim insists emphatically that is absolutely the wrong way of looking at it. The Divrei Chaim says the rule is that if a shliach, if an agent does something illegitimate, whatever he does is not binding, and the transaction is, can be unwound. What the agent did is simply steal. He let the house for below market rates and kept 30 rubles. He was basically stealing 30 rubles of the rent and taking it for himself. So he says, had the house still been up and the owner wanted to dissolve the rental arrangement, that would certainly be his prerogative because the agent acted improperly. Alternatively, he says, the owner of the house could simply let the deal stand and demand that the agent turn over the 30 rubles to him. He says, now that the house has burned down, the Ikra Lahalacha, although it is a machlokas, he says, but in this case at least, the Ikra Lahalacha is that the tenant has the right to demand the return of all of his, of the portion of the rent, which was for the duration of the lease, which will no longer hold because the house is burned down. So too, he says he has the right to demand back the 30 rubles. The 30 rubles, he says again, is just money that the broker, that the agent has stolen from the owner of the house. By taking a kickback, what he's simply doing is he said the house is clearly worth more. The tenant is paying more for it. He's simply taking part of the rent and pocketing it. So just like the tenant has the right to demand back the portion of the rent that went into the pocket of the rightful owner, so too he has the right to demand back the portion of the rent that the broker pocketed. The broker says, but I took a terrible risk for this because had he found out what I was doing, he would have hauled me into court and thrown me in jail. That's too bad. You took a risk. That's nice. But the money you took was still stolen from the owner, and the tenant has the right to demand it back. And the broker cannot argue you're willing to be mochel the money to me. The tenant says, no, I was willing to be mochel the money to you when I thought it was the homeowner's money we were stealing. I was willing to let you steal money from him. I wasn't such a tzaddik. Now that it's my money, because the house is burnt down and the rent reverts to me, I'm not interested in letting you have my money. So the broker, even though he took this great risk to steal some money and siphon off the kickback from the proceeds, which should have all gone to the homeowner, now that the house burned down, he must refund that money to the tenant.